Welcome, guys, to episode 106 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week I bring to you a man who was recommended by one of my past guests, Peter Park, and I've also enjoyed his podcast, which is called Finding Mastery, and my guest is Dr. Michael Gervais. Now, Dr. Gervais is a renowned sports psychologist. He's worked with many of the world's top athletes. And I was fortunate enough to pick his brains and see how it pertains to the first responders, the soldiers of the world. So we delved into many topics. We talked about the psychology of fear, flow state, how that tribal teamwork affects the outcome in the sports world, and obviously how we can apply it to the first responder community, and just an array of other topics that really tested me and made me look at the way I think and my own self-talk. And I definitely walked away from this realizing that I've been doing some destructive thinking myself. And it really kind of renewed the way I look at the internal monologue. So I really enjoyed this. So as I always say, please go to the iTunes, rate the show, share the show. That's the biggest thing. Just share. Help this project get to everyone that needs to hear it, and just share and share and share. Find a episode that you love and send it to everyone you know. So with that being said, I introduce to you Dr. Michael Gervais. Enjoy. So Dr. Gervais, thank you so much for coming on to the Behind the Shield podcast. The opening question I always have is, where are we finding you today?
Oh, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm honored to be part of your community. And I'm currently in Hermosa Beach in my office and in Southern California.
Okay, and were you born there or somewhere else?
No, I was actually born in a small town in Virginia. And I spent the first handful of years there. And then my family moved west in, I think it was like fourth grade. And then fourth grade onward, I've lived in California.
Okay, brilliant. Now, what I always delve into this a little bit, if it's okay. What was your family unit like? What did your mom and dad do? And how many siblings did you have?
So mom and dad, so I have one sister. That's the easiest place to start. Mom and dad. Mom stayed and ran the family, and dad early on pretty much worked for corporate America and worked his way through that ecosystem, but then also had very early days, had a strong kind of commitment around the house because we moved into the country and there was no street lights. I mean, we were out in the boonies. There was a commitment around making sure the family system was right, but he also had a corporate job at the same time.
Right. Now, was that in California in the boonies or in Virginia?
That was in Virginia. Yeah. So that's where I feel like I got some roots in Virginia. It was literally just way out in the middle of nowhere. It's a small town called Warrenton, which is built up quite a bit now. But when we were there 40 some years ago, it was tiny. And then in California, he was becoming more successful in the corporate world. And so I organically saw that happen.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to ask a question because I had Sebastian Junger on twice now. One of the things he writes about is the tribal mentality. And I love delving into that. And so I myself grew up on a farm in a somewhat small town as well. Did you find that you had that tribal, I don't know what the right word would be, that tribal element going on in Virginia, and did you find that you lost it when you went to suburban America in California?
What we had in Virginia was a family unit with some sparse neighbors. And so, no, I didn't have a tribal thing there. It was a family unit first, but it was, we're a small family of four. And then my grandparents were not far down the road. So there's a little bit of extended family there. So no, not a tribal thing. And then I didn't have a tribal thing in early days growing up in California. And I think the first tribe I was ever part of was my community of friends in high school when we were, our mutual interests were around surfing and getting better and progression. And so that was the first kind of tribal experience. And I loved it. I loved being part of it. A community where people know each other, support each other, challenging each other ripping each other, you know, like I just love that. And I just naturally kind of crave that community. And so it's not something I had early days, but high school, relatively early days, I guess you'd say.
Okay. Well, as a psychologist yourself, is that something that you've had any observations on as far as society in general?
What do you mean?
With regards to a tribal element being a positive experience and some areas of our sociology, I guess you could say, missing that, especially with electronics, and maybe that being one of the underlying issues that we have.
You know, it's a good question because we are social by nature, and social media is not necessarily helping that, but we are social beings. And I'm in an airport more than I'd like to be, and walking through the airport, you can see what's happening, like as a thin slice of the way that we're engaging. We hurry up to get somewhere to sit down, to look, to see what other people are doing. And our posture stooped, the whole thing. You know, people are really in this funky little space. Instead of reading magazines or reading newspapers, we're reading and looking at images. But then there's another layer that takes place, is that, like, let's say that a couple is sitting next to each other. They're flipping through their phone, looking at social media. But then they'll say, hey, look at this, look at this. And it's a funny little something. Or, hey, check out what Johnny's doing. So there is a social engagement that is binding people that are already in intimate relationships. And then there's this fringe thing that's happening where we're connected to people we haven't seen for a long time or might not even begin to know. So there's this fringe social engagement that's taking place. There's an intimate connection as a talk track that's happening around social engagement. But I'm not sure, like, it's ever going to replace eye contact. It's never going to replace, you know, the neurochemistry exchange when somebody talks about something intimate or scary or difficult. And so I'm not mad about social media in any ways. We are social beings. But at the same time, I think there's a balance that we need to look for between checking in what others are doing and checking in what ourselves are doing and checking in with our intimate loved. And so the tribal piece for me is like a much deeper commitment than a social gathering. You know, it's not like this, just the social gathering is cool, it's fun, it's whatever, a group of people get together for an experience. But then there's a team, and a team is like, okay, we're going to work together, we're going to try to figure something out. And layer deeper is tribe, where it's like we're in it, you know, and that's very much a family feel. And that is rare, you know, that is a really rare thing.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously you've worked with many, many just successful people in general, but you have worked with a lot of teams. Can you think of any specific examples of where that tribal element was missing and therefore they weren't successful versus one where, due to that tribal element, they were very successful?
Countless, you know. And before I got to the women's national team in volleyball, the U.S. women's national team, they were a high-performing team, kicking ass, top ranked in the world. Ended up taking a silver in the Olympics. So that's not bad. However, they lacked a community. They were performance razor edged in about their communication, their relationships, and the way they fit together. So the tribe was dangerous to each other, if you will. And then they wanted to do some purposeful work around it. So I was fortunate enough to spend time with them in the last quad, not the current quad, but the last quad heading into Rio. And they got the tribe right. They got the community right. And they really knew each other, support each other, challenge each other, were on the journey together, and did great. But they didn't get the outcome that we had hoped for. Everyone's vying for better than silver, for gold, if you will. And we ended up getting a bronze. Now, I'll say that the community was really strong and the experience was worthwhile. And when I asked some of the gals about their experience in the previous quad versus this quad, so when they got a silver and it was hard, there was no real meaningfulness in relationships, and then getting a bronze, but felt connected. And most of them, if not, I think there's just one that said otherwise, contrary to the statement, they said, oh yeah, this is way better. The 4 years was great. Yeah, you know, I think we underperformed a little bit. But damn, like the 4 years was awesome, and I've got lifelong friends, and You know, like I learned so much about myself and how I work and others work in close-knit organizations. And I'm going to use this stuff in business later. So, and family raising, you know, later. So, you know, that's got a little bit of both in there. And I don't think it's ever as clean as if you have a tight tribal community that you're going to win a lot. I think that you give yourself a better chance to maximize the output, but it doesn't mean that the output's going to necessarily yield in results. So I hope that's not too complicated.
not at all.
In the thought. Yeah. So that's a pretty simple thought, I think.
Brilliant. Well, because the reason I ask, and I'm so involved in this particular concept, is in a firehouse, obviously in a military unit as well, that tribal element is very important. If we're a cohesive unit, then we're going to effectively rescue or save whatever individual we've gone into to help. But if there is a breakdown in the tribal element just within the firehouse itself, whether it's cleaning or cooking, you know, or people not talking to each other because they're on their phones or separate bedrooms, I see, you know, just with my own eyes, a direct result when it comes to the fireground operations. So, you know, I think there's a yearning in my profession to bring that tribal element back, that brotherhood that we talk about. So it's always interesting to go to the sports world and see that cause and effect of that cohesive team. And then the success, like you said, whether it's actually the medal they're looking for or just playing very well together and having a positive experience.
Well, you know, okay, so James, it's funny because you're looking to the sport team and I don't think you're going to find it. You know, I think what you guys have is way, what do I want to say? It's, you're grounded in something that is deeper. And so saving lives is far deeper than winning trophies. And so I'm not sure you're going to find it in the sport world. We work our ass off to get to team, to go from group to team. And to get into from team to tribe is rare. It's a rare space. And to do that, I think there's some extraordinary things that need to happen. One, the environment needs to be situated properly where people can really get to know each other. And it's not just about performance-driven outcomes. That is where I've learned so much from Coach Carroll up at the Seattle Seahawks, is the environment that he creates that is relationship-based. And that sets the stage for tribe. But we need to have like shared experiences that are hard and feel like it's as authentic as war, which it never will be. Never will be. It will never be as real as saving a human's life that you experience on a regular basis. So my regard for sure is for you guys, that the pedestal's very high for you guys. So I'm not sure sport will get you there. Sport will get you on some practices that will help coalesce people, to get people to think in similar ways. But I'm not sure that it can ever replace what you guys naturally have. So I think you're better situated than we are, if that is a long way to say that short little phrase.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it's interesting to hear that perspective, you know, with the mirror face the other way around. Well, I want to delve into that a little bit. So you spoke very positively of your experience with surfing. So does that tie into when you first became aware of the power of the mind in the sport performance world?
Oh, yeah. So I was a young kid and super green, really just wanted to get better. And I had this natural inclination to get better, to put the work in, to be out in the ocean, to take, you know, as many risks as I can, get myself scared every day, and working actively to get fearful and fatigued. Like, those are the two things I was looking for. But then as soon as the lights turned on and the judges were there and, you know, family members were showing up and there was judging and there's quote unquote pressure, which is just a ridiculous thought as an adult now to me, that I just was a shell of myself. I didn't think right. I couldn't feel my body right. I was so tense and nervous that I couldn't do what I normally could do on a regular basis. And that's when I first felt that pain, that uncomfortableness led to a pain that I said, what is going on? It's not my surfing ability. It's the way that I think about myself. And that's when it started to snap into place, like, hey, how do I get better at this thing? Because I'm an anxious mess right now. Like, it was awful. And I think, Greg, you've probably been there too. I don't know. I would imagine that, you know, James, you felt that, and, you know, I don't know. Yes. That's where it started for me. Yeah.
Okay. But you're in that mess point, because I can absolutely agree with that. And it's funny, I just had a conversation with a fellow fireman the other day. And what we see now is a fusion of the stresses and the fears and the exhaustion emotionally and physically that some of these men and women have, starting to intermingle with that anxiety. And then that creates a fear of doing tasks that before they would have been okay doing. So I really want to delve into that as we go along. But so what was it that you started changing to minimize that performance anxiety that you were having?
Well, at the time, I didn't know what to do. So I just had the awareness that, oh, there's something here. And looking back, it's led me to this thought that there's only three things as humans we can train, maybe four. But for right now, from a science standpoint, I'm going to say three. You can train your craft, you can train your body, and you can train your mind. That's it. So no longer are the best in the world leaving the mindset piece or the mental skills piece up to chance. And so they're investing in very sophisticated ways to train their mind. But at that point, 30 some years ago, I had no clue where to go. I don't think really anyone, strike that. It's not that there wasn't anyone. It was just the beginning of an industry thinking about the science of how the extraordinary mind works. So for the histories of psychology, it was about how the broken mind works. And so I didn't know. And so I just started studying the mind. And the only thing that was really available to me was some fringe kind of tapes from pop psychology-esque type folks that were talking about motivation. And, you know, I'll leave the names out because it wasn't grounded in good enough science to warrant what they're talking about. And then the dysfunctional mind. You know, like how schizophrenia or bipolar or depression or anxiety. But it wasn't until about 40 years ago where the emergence of science became interesting to scientists. And it wasn't until like the last 20 years that it became pop awareness, where it was pop culture to it. Like, how did the best and the best of the best train their minds? And so the easy answer for your thoughtful question was, I didn't know. I just thought that there was something there I should train. And I just started learning about the mind, but it was mostly about the dysfunctional mind. And eventually I found the graduate school track about sports psychology and how elite athletes, the science of how elite athletes condition their mind.
Right.
But that wasn't until another, 15 years later.
So what were you doing career-wise at that point?
Well, I barely got out of high school. High school was not a good fit for me. I didn't learn right. Let me say it better. I wasn't interested in learning the things that were offering in formal education. And so I was not a good high school student. So I barely got out of high school and I didn't have the grades, nor did I take an SAT or a PSAT. I went surfing on both of them. So there's no way I could get into college. My parents gave me this ultimatum that I either get a job and move out, or I go to community college. So I knew I could go to school and keep surfing. So I went to community college. It was a little private school called Marymount College that was a two-year program. And it was just like, I don't know, three golf ball pitches away from a really good surf break. So that's where I went. But what ended up happening is that I fell in love, literally fell in love with, the invisible. And philosophy became interesting. Theology became really interesting, the science of like spiritual practices. And then psychology was like a little bit more concrete than both of them. And so I love all three of those and how they work. And so I started really becoming interested in the science of psychology. So that's how it happened for me. And then once I caught wind of it, no one ever had to ask me to read another book again in psychology. Like, I was reading as much as I could get my hands on. And I'm not a reader. That's not how I was born. But I don't know if I was born that way. It's a little bit too much. But that's not who I was at that time. But I did like to learn and I wanted to figure things out and I was interested in improvement. And so that's a long story to get to it. But yeah.
Well, it's funny you use that example because I was the same way. I didn't struggle in school, but I did not enjoy school at all. And I was a straight, C student at best. But then when I went through fire school and paramedic school, I was a straight A student. And it's, again, that underlying thing that I know you talk a lot about, which is understanding your why, that burning desire inside you of what you're really meant to do on this earth.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And you know what? That's hard. that's a difficult thing to wrestle with. I was talking with Bob Hurley yesterday, and Bob Hurley is the founder of Hurley Clothing. And like, I mean, it's a Billabong, Quiksilver, Hurley, Volcom. Those are some of the big brands in surfing. And I was fortunate enough to sit down with Bob Hurley, and he says, every day I think about my purpose. So somebody who's even who's made a global impact on the surf industry and the clothing company is still thinking about purpose. I just found that so remarkable. And so it's a hard question to think about. What am I doing here? What is my purpose? And there's no shortcut to that. And it really does, clarity of that comes from asking that question a lot, writing it down, talking about it with wise people, and seeing how it snaps together with what you are actually competent at doing. You know, because if your purpose is, if you think your purpose is to make guitars, but you've got, you know, a bunch of thumbs and you can't hold a screwdriver very well and your artistic eye and your ear is out of whack, you know, are all compromised, then it's going to be hard to make things that are going to purposefully change the world. So there's got to be some sort of competency. There's got to be some sort of relationship piece to it. And then the ability to have the autonomy to choose the way that you think, the way that you organize your actions. And those three things, competency, autonomy, and relatedness, are all drivers for deep motivation. And that's the work of DC and Ryan, DCI is the last name, DC and Ryan, and their work on motivation.
Brilliant. Well, that's an interesting point that you bring up as well, because what we see in the fire service, you have your absolute go-getters that are 25 years in and still just enamored with the job and training every day. But you get a very large portion in the middle. You get the bottom portion that probably should never have been in the job in the first place. And I'll just say that now. But there's a middle portion that are swayed depending on their environment. If they're around a bunch of go-getters, they'll probably be more fired up. But there are some factors physiologically that definitely are challenges to motivation as well. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But when you have an individual, I know you don't just work with sports athletes, you work with a whole array of people. How do you nurture maintaining that motivation that people initially had, and they truly were doing their burning desire, their passion, but 10 years later, you know, whether it's a business that's beating them down, whether it's like my profession with the sleep deprivation and the calls that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be running, that kind of thing. How do you keep that inspiration internally yourself without relying on other people to carry you through that career?
It's the right question, James. That's a right question, because external conditions are important. And being around people that are vibrant and are switched on and are hungry is, I mean, it's worth its weight in platinum for sure. That being said, it's not enough. And it does need to come from within. And my experience is like, what does that mean? That's why I go back to DC and Ryan's approach called the self-determination theory is, you know, are you working on mastery competency, right? Are you really feeling authentically yourself? Do you have the autonomy that, because when people don't feel autonomous, they get bitter. When they feel like they're doing things with that they should be doing for approval, or doing things that others think they should be doing for the job, people get bitter. And they get pissed and they get anxious and they get, you know, a bit overwhelmed about things. And if we don't have good relationships that are stimulating and are lined up to help us get better, it becomes really challenging to have that inner drive, that inner fire, if you will, stay flamed. And so I take a look, a deep dive at those three, and then I take a look at fear and fatigue. And if I'm not recovering properly, it's nearly impossible to stay the course. So fear and fatigue are big deals, and managing those. So like really, you know, taking care of your system. And the fear thing is also critical. So the fear piece is making sure that we are thinking properly about this moment and making sure that we're connected to this moment on a regular basis rather than worrying about all the things that could go wrong. So those are the two things, or the five, I guess, if you will, that I think about a lot.
The recovery, the sleep, is so important. I know that you just did a blog recently about that. But it's something that the first responders of the world, every third day or whatever, if they're PD, they're on these rotating shifts, in their career, they're literally missing years of sleep over a 25, 30-year career. And so this recovery is absolutely contributing to the mental ill health, the physical ill health. So I kind of want to just, without loading the question, for your athletes, for your business people, for all your other clients, if you wouldn't mind, just explain to me, in your opinion, the value of the sleep and the detriments of missing that sleep.
Great topic. And I think people will be surprised if we pull back the curtain on elite athletics and elite sport and, you know, really show you how we think and what we talk about. I think you'd be surprised about how much we actually talk about recovery. And the science and art of recovery is square one. Because if bodies break down, minds follow quickly, and vice versa as well. If minds break down because of monotony and, the strain is so high that people don't recover in a thinking strategy, the bodies break down. So everyone on the world stage pushes hard. Like that's it's not a question. Everyone's working hard. So it's not a question of work harder. That's like, that feels stupid to talk about. We need to work harder. Yes, everybody works hard. So the intelligent, competitive, advanced organizations are talking about intelligent recovery. So we want to get, for every unit of strain, we want to have an equal unit of recovery. It's that simple. Now what's a unit of strain and what's a unit of recovery? That's where the art is. That's where the science and art meet together. But for some basic things like, okay, so there's five basic primary recovery strategies. First is sleep right. That's the biggest one now. If you don't sleep right, your brain does something very funny. It says, ooh, okay, we're not consolidating properly. We're not recovering properly. So if we're going to have to put a big output out, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to lower the level of normal functioning. And so our brain does a very sneaky, slippery thing, is that it creates a new normal, but that new normal is suboptimal. And it's a strategy to conserve energy so we don't blow ourselves up. And so we become better at maybe moderate ways of living, but we don't provide enough to have optimal ways of living. And so sleep is the big banger. You got to get it in. If you can't get it in, there's no excuse for the other variables, which is eat and hydrate well, move well, think in optimal ways, optimism, and I can go on and on about some of the think well strategies, and then be in a community of people that are like-minded and vibrant and on it. So those are the recovery pieces together. And it's silly to think that we can play the long game in an optimized way when we're, grinding ourselves to a nub. Now, again, I want to just make this point. If you can't get sleep because of the rhythm of your job or you've got a sleeping disorder, then get the other three right. Get the other four right. See if you could lock in two of the other five, three of the other five. Lock them in. There's no excuse in modern day worlds to not eat and hydrate properly. That's laziness. That's choosing comfort rather than performance. And I'm telling you, I've got just a low threshold of tolerance for that, because people want to say, I'm not getting enough sleep. Well, okay, I get it. Well, how are you doing on eating? Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Oh, good. What'd you have for breakfast? Oh, I had some bacon and eggs. What are you talking about? what do you mean? So cholesterol and fat and bad fat? Like, that's what you did? Come on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's what I try and do with this project. I always talk about this being a double-edged sword. So there's the ownership component. And, I try and walk the walk. I'm certainly not perfect by any means, but I try and, show people that I'm eating well, that I'm exercising, that I'm taking classes and all these other things, mindful practice. But then there's the other side, which is the environment that a lot of these men and women are working under, where the sleep deprivation is definitely something that the employer needs to change. A lot of these men and women are working 56-hour weeks and then getting mandatory, for another 24 in that week. And so it's really setting them up for failure. And I don't think it's something that people are doing maliciously, but I just don't think there's a great understanding in the sleep medicine world of the negative effects of the lack of sleep. And so when we see you know, the vehicle collisions in the fire service, and you know, obviously the actual deaths of the first responders, be it suicide or heart attacks, you start bringing that all in, and like you said, there's the one component which is the ownership. Well, how were you eating before you got ill? But then the other side is the sleep as well. So my goal is to inspire the men and women to take care of themselves and all the elements that they can do. But just like you said, then encourage them to start working on their employer as to the environment, and educate them that some of these environments that they're working under are setting them up for failure instead of success.
Flat out, you know, it's great. And it's not easy, I'll tell you that, you know, like with travel and alarms, and it's not, there's, when I'm fortunate enough to spend time with elite organizations like Fortune 100 franchises that have a global footprint, and they have many of the same issues. So they're not first responder type stuff where they're woke up at 3 a.m. Actually, you know, there are some groups that are problem solvers that have to do that. And they talk about they're on 4-hour stints, you know, 4 hours here, 4 hours there every night, broken 4 hours. And it's just, it's really hard. So your environment is unique. That from the cheap seats, it's like, I don't know if there could be something more important than figuring out how to optimize recovery during the day. And that would be mindfulness. That would be literally meditation as part of the practice. It would be napping. It would be kick-ass food, like without a doubt. It'd be investing in optimal ways of thinking, because we know pessimistic, anxious, frustrated, intolerant people spend more energy when they're awake than those that are optimistic, grounded, present, and have a high threshold for irritability. And so I'm flat out investing in thinking strategies, or mindset training, as we call it, you know, is definitely an advantage.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I've heard you talking about optimism, so I'd love to elaborate a bit, because you, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but you talk about the relationship between fear and optimism. Is that correct? And if so, if you wouldn't mind elaborating on it.
Okay. Well, let me just start with optimism first. Optimism and pessimism are learned behaviors. So there might be some, you know, proclivity in genetic coding to come into the world a bit anxious, but we haven't found a signature that says, oh, this type of people are optimistic, or this type of genome is, you know, mapping towards pessimism. It's not that way. So we think at best go, it's a learned behavior, which begs the question, who did you learn it from? And if you learned it primarily from, let's say, your parents, which most people learn their psychological framework from their parents and early experiences, and then don't change them until there's some sort of crisis, mini crisis, or deep desire to grow. Let's say your parents were just flat out amazing, and they really came from a trusting place, and they were pretty much optimistic in general. You're likely going to be an optimist, which means that you're going to look into the world, to your future. So optimism, pessimism, sorry, let me give a definition, is the way that the lenses that you view the future through. And optimism is like this idea that something good's about to take place, so let me explore. Pessimism is the lenses that things don't work out. So I don't think it's going to work out for me. And I will tell you that I have not met, is that the right way to say this? Like let me be more positive the way I say it. 100% of the best in the world that I've worked with have an optimistic frame. Of course they believe, if they apply their efforts, that it's going to work out. Why would they put their ass out there? Why would they strain and try so hard? They fundamentally believe that good things happen to them. And it's an amazing experience that's right around the corner. And that's why you know, for the most part, you see people compete to the very end. Now, some organizations and some people they get information that comes into their system through their senses. They see something like they're down by 40 points, or they feel something like, oh, those guys are just, they're outmatching us. And they start to go into a pessimistic frame. And that's actually not like totally pessimistic. It's just being judgmental and trying to save one's exposure to pain. So they throw in the towel early. And well, I don't want to be part of them. I don't think you do either. I would bet that most first responders have an optimistic frame. And then, but pr- probably could use some benefit of sharpening that to make sure that the cynical nature that some organizations like to, you know, to have, which is fun. You know, there can be fun and sarcasm and cynicism, but it can become this kind of pervasive thing that chips away at a fundamental optimism. So again, let me go back to my point. Optimism and pessimism are learned. It begs the question, who did you learn it from? And if you are pessimistic or have some sort of that way about yourself, it is useful, we think, to invest in training optimism. So how do you train optimism? Well, if you take a look at good science, there's some really good research out of UPenn that suggests that just finding and exploring and writing down three amazing things every day and just writing those things down could be considered a way to train optimism. And so that's one of the ways that we think about it. We hold people accountable to finding what's amazing in their life and talking about it or writing it down. And that's actually a training mechanism. You can do that socially in a tribe, or you could do it individually. And how does it relate to anxiety? Back to your point, is that those that scan the world and find things pervasively that are going to go wrong certainly should be more anxious because they're more connected to all the things that could go wrong. Those that scan the world and find what could be amazing, it could be great, and it's based in reality, not some naive approach, they live in a little bit more grounded, safe world. Literally, their world is a little bit safer. And so, so those are some ways to think about optimism, pessimism, and anxiety.
Yeah, well, I love that because I think, for example, let's take the training ground that we have. I know there's a resistance to training sometimes because people are afraid to quote unquote look stupid, you know, make mistakes. But I think with an optimistic mindset, you already know that if you make a mistake, you're going to learn from it. So you're just going to grow anyway. And I think that, yes, that separates that from the people that are, I guess, pessimistic in a way that they're more worried about their pride and shame than they are the ultimate result, which is being able to save that life when you're relied on to do so.
Yeah, and if you think about most of your crew, I bet they don't run. By the way, my dad lived in a firehouse for a number of years, you know, when he was growing up. So I've got stories in my mind about, from a distance about what it's like.
Oh, brilliant.
In your world. Yeah, and so I bet most don't look at a situation and go, okay, so guys, this probably isn't going to work out. You know, it's probably not going. But you guys have to use good judgment. You have to look at the situation and say, you know what? It's too much. It is too much. Like us going in is not the right way to do things. You know, but I bet for the most part, most people are optimistic in your world. And so, but there is anxiety that is a second cousin, if you will, to optimism. But anxiety is a separate skill that can be trained as well.
Right. Well, I want to feed into that if we can. So me personally, and I'll just give you my anecdote and then you tell me if I'm an anomaly or this is actually, you know, some solid science to it. But I have, you know, the I would say the natural anxiety towards almost like an imposter syndrome, like I'm going to fail. But the overriding thing is, I compensate for it by training. And the training, to me, removes the fear, because when that kind of conscious mind gets thrown back when the emergency comes in and you're literally almost acting automatically, after the fact I look back and go, okay, my training did work, so that kind of anxiety went away. Do you find that in all the people that you train, that one of the best ways of combating fear and anxiety is just to train in the first place?
Well, you've got, okay, partly right. So you can't fake anything, because you know you're faking it. You know that you haven't done the real work. So it's partly right. So proper preparation is a requirement, but it's not enough, right? It's necessary, but sufficient. And the reason it's necessary, but not sufficient, is because anxiety comes from an excessive worry about what could go wrong. What is the antidote for anxiety is confidence, which is a relationship that you have with yourself about what you think you can do. So confidence only comes from one place, which is not your preparation. It comes from what you say to yourself about your preparation in relationship to the demands that are coming down the pipe. Okay, so if you haven't done the work, you probably should be nervous. Okay. Like in life, if you know, and in performance, you haven't done the work, you probably should be nervous. If you've done the work and you know that the work has been solid and you have a way of maintaining your integrity about your skills, what your skills actually are, and you say, you know what, my skills are X, the demand coming down in this event are X plus one, I think I can do that. But if you say that my skills are X and you perceive the demands of the environment to be X plus 10, you probably should be very nervous. So self-talk is essential, and self-talk has to be credible based on what you've experienced and done in your past as an estimate of what you can do in the future. So that, I mean, it's a kind of a technical way to think about your relationship to training, but I've seen plenty of people that are, they've put in blood, sweat, and tears flat out. They've trained their ass off to do what they do. And then I'm thinking right now of cage fighting, and in the gym, on the mat, they're incredible and they put in the right work. And in the back warm-up ready room, they are feeling pretty good, but they've got some elevated nervousness or anxiousness going on. And then by the time they walk up the five steps to get into the cage, they've given themselves away. They've turned over and exposed their soft belly because of what they've been saying to themselves for the last 45 minutes to an hour and a half. And so the success alone, the preparation and even past success is not enough. You've got to really have that hardiness about yourself, that steeliness to say, bullshit, like I put in the work, let's go. I'm here to test my skills, you know, and this is what I've decided to do with my life. This is what I've trained for. And I don't have all the answers. And I, because of that, I need to figure out how to love the unknown. And those that are anxious, they don't really love what they do. They don't really love it. What they love is relief. What they love is the escape that happens when it's over and they feel good about it. And they love what the thing does for them, not the actual grinding of figuring out, do I have skills? They're more afraid of what other people think of them than the actual love of being tested. And so, I say all this to you right now, and I know your community is going, what is he talking about? Like, you know, because there's an old thought that I'm battling, and it's been, you know, around for hundreds of years. Nervousness is okay. It means you care. No, that's wrong. That comes from a very unsophisticated place. That's not right. Your system should turn on. You should have an alarm phase that kicks on when something is important to you. Fight, flight, freeze, submission, or flow state are all options. And so, yes, your system should turn on. And knowing what to do with that arousal, switching on, adrenaline thing is what somebody who has mastery of self is all about. It does not mean nervousness. It means readiness. But if you don't know what to do with the internal activation, and you feel your body, you say to yourself, oh, shit, like maybe I'm not ready. Now, that's literally an untrained, undisciplined mind. And so I feel like I got to get off my little soapbox here. I get so animated because I've felt all the pain that so many people have felt. And I wish I knew what I know now that at age 15 and 25, even, you know, it is not hard. It's not hard to train your mind. It's not. But we've got these old thinking patterns that, you know, I don't know. They just slow us down. It's not some of our models, psychological framework models that have been passed down from ancestors. Our ancestors are not good for us.
Yeah. So. No, you absolutely, you haven't been, you know, every single word that you've said is going to resonate deeply because there are people that are put in the work that are still terrified of heights, you know, that, you know, are great firefighters that their knees start knocking at 10 feet up. And so it's an interesting thing to explore because I guess the Neanderthal in all of us is just, you know, calling them a bunch of profanity and then tell them to get their scared ass up the ladder, you know. But it's interesting to delve deeper and see, well, okay, well, what can we get them to do, like you said, with the self-talk while we're doing this training that's going to increase their resilience?
Yeah, so that's a nice one. So it's actually not increasing resilience. It's increasing capacity. So resiliency is going through difficult times and being able to bounce back.
Right.
Right? So like that what you're describing is not resiliency. What you're describing is building the capacity. And there's two capacities to build. One capacity is awareness of your inner dialogue and the skill to choose great thoughts. That you can train that, right? That's not hard to do. The second capacity is the awareness of your arousal levels, heart rate, you know, your body being switched on, and then the skill to manage that. And those are both mental skills that we're talking about. So awareness comes first and then skills. So what helps people calm down? Breathing. What helps people become more aware of their arousal levels? Mindfulness. What helps people, you know, the skill of speaking well to yourself? That's self-talk. What helps people become more aware of inner dialogue? Self-talk. Mindfulness. So it's not hard, but like, let's just use the latter example for a moment before I go to the more concrete example. Good science would suggest anywhere between 8 minutes and 20 minutes, you know, of investing in a mindfulness practice to create some real change. And if you do it once, you're not going to get much change. If you do it for a month, you'll get a little bit of change. You do it for 6 months, you'll see some stuff. You do it for 6 years, you're going to really notice a difference. And the whole game, before I get to the concreteness, is to go from training a skill to having a state, an optimized state more often. So from skill to state, and then from state, once we have an optimized state more often, it just might turn into an enduring trait where it becomes a signature strength of yours that's reliable and durable. And so from skill to state to trait is kind of the arc that we're looking for. And, you know, I would encourage you to go down the path of like using something super concrete about ladder climbing or heights and do some searching on systematic desensitization. And it's a great evidence-based protocol about how to train somebody that has a fear response. If they get up to 5 steps, you know, and that's where their knees start to shake, we'll get them to 4, teach them how to think properly and then how to breathe properly. And they don't get to go to step 5 until they're calm. And they get to step 5 and their knees start to shake, right? And they're rattling. Okay, well, they need to think right and breathe right and be in that moment. And they can't go down or up until they master a sense of control on step 5. And then they can go down, or they can go to 6 and they start to rattle at 6. Same thing. Go back to the thinking strategies to optimize them and the breathing to until they get calm. Systematic desensitization, great program, evidence-based, really clean. There's 4 or 5 steps prior to what I just described to you in that protocol, but it's really nice.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think that'd be very helpful to a lot of people because we challenge ourselves in so many ways. And obviously the PD side, those guys have the fact that someone's trying to kill them is the main thing. But for us, whether it's going down tight spaces, climbing through a collapsed building, going up an elevation, you know, there's so many challenges to the nervous system that, you know, you really do have to get controlled. So if you're claustrophobic or you're fear of heights or you're scared of water, you know, there's all these elements that we have to overcome. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of people listening to this that would really find that important. So thank you. So you touched on the state. I want to go all the way to the other side now. And I hear this phrase all the time. And I think I experienced it maybe a few times in emergencies, but one time as an athlete, I was a Taekwondo practitioner years ago, and I remember a specific fight where I could visualize exactly what the person was going to do before they did it, reacted accordingly, went from being, I think it was 8 points to 0 deficit to knocking this guy down, ended up winning the fight. And I'm assuming that was what they call a flow state. So would you mind educating me as to what a flow state is and how that applies in life in general?
Sure. It's not complicated, you know, as a experience because you've already had it and you know what it feels like to be at your very best. And there's a distortion of time that happens for most people, but 80% of people in flow state have a distortion of time, which is like, whoa, that was 45 minutes or, oh my God. Like it felt like that those 10 seconds felt like an hour. I felt like I could do anything I wanted inside those 10 seconds. So it's when you, excuse me, just gasping for air. It's literally when you are at your best. And that's what a flow state is. It's the most optimized experience a person can be in. And so how do you get there more often? Well, you know, it's a big part of the inner game, which is interpreting your environment to be challenging and honoring that you have the skills to match that demand. It is embracing the unknown and the risk that comes with that. It's having very clear goals about what it is that you need to do or want to do and how you want to do it. It's being in an environment where the feedback loops are rich so that you know from a moment-to-moment feedback loop how you're doing. And like those are some of the conditions that precede and can be actually manipulated, if you will, and trained to increase the frequency of flow state. And good, again, I want to come back to mindfulness. There's a nice little piece of research that those that practice mindfulness have an increased frequency in flow state. And so mindfulness a la meditation is what most people call it, is a low threshold, entry to threshold training. You know, you don't even have to break a sweat. You just have to basically sit still or walk mindfully for 8 minutes. You know, maybe 1 minute if that's all you can get in, you know, but so it's relatively low threshold.
All right. Well, that was a great segue into a big part that I wanted to ask about, which was mindful practice. I've been exposed to it a little bit through Rodney Yee, the yoga guru, and then Headspace, the app. I can say right now, I have experienced great benefits. I've fallen off the wagon myself. I'll be the first to admit it. And I'm trying to get myself back on there. So how do you take the average person and basically, what would be the first few steps to lead them into finding the right mindful practice for them? And then, as you kind of touched on before, what volume of mindful practice they should try and aspire to get?
Well, I think that there's so many types of mindfulness. There's no science that would say for this type of person, this is the right duration and this is the right type. So we're too early in the science there. But what I would suggest people do is maybe just do a quick little investigation on why you're curious about mindfulness. Like, what is it that you're looking for? And so just be clear about like the purpose of why you want to train it. Is it for recovery? You know, that's good. But the real main focus is to increase your awareness. So you become more aware of your thoughts, emotions, your body sensations, the environment around you, so that you can adjust and pivot in a more authentic, optimized way. And that's like the first pillar. And the second pillar is to reveal the wisdom, the true nature of things about yourself and about the world. Like that, those are the two big pillars of mindfulness. The gold dust in modern times is relaxation, but that's just the gold dust. So I think it's important to go like really get really clear, like what are you looking for? Why are you doing it? And if you're doing it because, you know, somebody told you to do it, that's not right. And if you're doing it because, you know, if one of your community members are doing it because they respect you, that's not quite right. It's good, but it's not going to last. And so getting crisp on that is the first thing. And then there's two types of mindfulness. There's single point and then contemplative. Single point is just as simple as focusing on one thing for an extended period of time. And then your mind wanders and you gently bring it back. That's it. And contemplative, let's put a pin in that one. It's a little bit more complicated. And I would suggest starting with single point, starting with focusing on breathing. And the reason I like breathing as opposed to anything that you could focus your mind on is that you're, until you die, your breathing is always available to you. And so I would start there. And then I could go one level kind of deeper. And there's lots of ways to think about breathing training. And there's some relatively new science around it, but there's been some ancient traditions for a while. But even as far as 20 years ago, people were saying, hey, listen, somewhere between 5 and 6 breaths a minute is going to impact people's heart rate variability and their responses to stress. And if you think about that, you know, if we're looking at somewhere between 5 and 6 breaths per minute, and we've got 60 seconds in a minute, that means each breath is somewhere between 10 and 12 seconds. And so then if I could add one more layer to this, if you focused on a breath up for 8, up for 4 and out for 6, that's cool. maybe you want to extend it a little bit longer and go up for 8 and out for 12, yeah, you can get around the four breaths per minute, somewhere in that range. Or you want to do box breathing and you go, you know, up for 3, out for 3, up for 3, hold for 3, out for 3, pause for 3 at the bottom, you know, somewhere in that range. So I would just, I can't give you too much because I don't want to overwhelm folks, but at the same time, it's like, just focus on making your exhale longer than your inhale. That's it. Like, make your exhale longer than your inhale and focus on that as if a loved one's life depended on you getting it right. That would be the right type of way to do it.
Well, I found very good success with that on the way to a call. When obviously we get calls that it's a sprained ankle, you're not really too anxious about that. But when it's the, you know, pediatric code or some of these other ones that really have the potential for sparking our adrenal system, I do that on the way to the call. I wouldn't even say it was box breathing, more what you were talking about, a slow inhalation, a slow exhalation. But what's even more pertinent is when we are in the fire, if we're actually on a fire call, we only have enough air. Yeah, the air on our back is all we have in the world. So the more control we are with our breathing, the anxiety portion, the mental portion, but even the physiological portion, the more air we have, the more chance we A, have to reach someone, and B, get ourselves out safely as well.
That's exactly it. And then I would challenge you, you know, James, maybe to do that breathing every day, right? So that you're not just doing it in crisis mode to manage, but you're front loading the training to get ahead of it so that you do have better controls of your arousal system, your nervous system, as well as potentially slipping into some really deep understanding and, you know, some awareness. Because what ends up happening when you're focusing all of your essence on your breathing, you become better at spending time in the present moment. And the present moment is where you experience high performance, but more importantly, you reveal wisdom.
Yeah. And another thing that I suffer from is the monkey mind. And I heard, I think it was Wayne Dyer talking about, I'm sure I've got the numbers completely wrong, but we have 10,000 thoughts a day on 100 things. And that's definitely what my mind is. And I think it's made worse by social media and all the other inputs that we have. And when I've been doing this mindful practice, it's just calmed that down. And I know that we talk about it a lot. You don't meditate once and everything goes away. You become aware of it, but just clearing the white noise from my brain is so restorative in itself.
That's it. You know, that's great. And I don't, just be clear, I don't agree with the 10,000 thoughts. But yes, the concept is right on the money.
Okay, well, let's explore that then. So what would be your take on that whole concept?
For thoughts?
Yeah, for white noise.
The whole job is to get from signal to from noise to signal. Like, that's our job, right? Get out the noise, get to the signal. That's our job definitely for first responders, definitely for people on the path of mastery, is get to the signal. What's the signal? And the signal can only be experienced in the present moment. And if your monkey mind, your wandering mind, your undisciplined mind, which is most of our minds, is can't really tell the difference between signal and noise, we got problems. And if it's undisciplined and connected to the noise, we got problems. And so how do you get better at it is training your mind to be in the present moment more often. That's where mindfulness is such an advantage for performance. Let alone, I don't know, James, if you know a wise man or woman, like a true wise woman or a true wise man.
I was going to say, what would be a stereotypically wise person, though?
And they're rare because most people are more interested in performance and looking good than like wisdom. And so like wisdom, when people have wisdom, they just don't get rattled. It's wonderful. It's not crazy. It's wonderful. You know, they understand the fragility of now because they've explored the depths of death. And they're like, yeah, okay, well, now's all we get. How are we going to do now? Oh, poor thing. You're going to be nervous about now? Nothing's really even happening right now. It's just a conversation. You know, like, oh, okay, so you're in your truck heading to the call. Well, okay, good. So you know, this is really important. I hope that you'll be your very best because people are counting on you. You know, it's just wisdom is different and it's awesome.
And do you think they achieve that through mindful practice and just controlling their own thoughts?
Awareness. Spending more time in the present moment, thinking about things deeply, you know, whether that's writing or in conversation or mindfulness. Those are the three ways I think that wisdom is revealed. And through inspired conversations, writing some shit down that's deep, and then, you know, listening, you know, and when you, the challenge when you write things down is it forces you to choose some words. It doesn't mean it's any good, but like it's there's a practice there too.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned earlier about the study of writing down three things that you're, you know, grateful for, optimistic. I have the 5-minute journal, which I'm sure has spawned from that study in some way. And again, it just forces you to be gracious in the morning, have gratitude, and then to do the same thing before you go to bed and try and unload some of that mental baggage.
That's it. Nice work.
All right. Well, talking about that, so I listened to you on the Ultimate Health podcast. They had you on as a guest, you talked about the 60-second waking practice, and I'd love to get that on recording for this too. So I'll elaborate a little bit. Are there and other things that you would recommend people do on a daily basis to try and start steering themselves towards mastery of themselves?
Well, I think this is too small. It's a beginnings. You know, it's cool and it's a beginnings. Could be wonderful. I'd really, there's so much I'd want to share with your audience and your community about the path of mastery, but certainly this is a nice little easy entry point. So the four steps, one is one breath. Before you take your sheets off, one breath. That's it. And it's, if you want to do two, nice. If you want to do more than that, great, no problems. But like one full breath where the exhale is longer than the inhale. And that comes before you check Instagram, Twitter, you know, or even have thoughts about all the busyness and things you need to get done today. Like just one deep inhale and exhale. Then step two is one thought of gratitude. Just wake up that part of your brain and your mind to focus on what's good and what you're grateful for. And we have a thought that gratitude precedes joy and happiness. And so that's just kind of priming the right structures in your brain. And if you want to have more than one thought, again, great. That's totally cool. And then step three is one intention. And that's a fancy word for how do you want to be today? And if you can be really crisp, like when I get to the, the office, or when I, you know, see the guys and or the team or whatever, that you say, how do I want to do that? And it's just a quick little frame. And then, so those are three steps. And then the last is take your sheets off, put your feet on the ground, and just be where your feet are. And that one can get corny. So beware, you know, and it can kick up some ideas like, what am I doing? Oh, wait, that's right. Just be where my feet is. Wait, this is weird. Why am I doing this? God, look at that. I really am hard on myself. I can't even quiet my mind and be where my feet are. Okay, let me start. Okay, let me just feel my feet on the ground. What am I doing? You know, like that's the experience that happens on that last one. So it's just a nice little moment to check in to the quality of your mind. Can you just be where your feet are? So those are the four steps, and it's not check the box. It's be in it. Do each one of those with all of your essence and might. And that's the way a great way to start the day.
All right. Well, you said that before about reaching out to the audience. So I would love it if you're okay, if you have the ability to do it in a time frame that suits you. You have the men and women now listening that truly want to find mastery. So we've been talking about some of these kind of piecemeal topics that I've been throwing at you. But myself, for example, you know, my goal as a firefighter, as a medic, is to be the best damn firefighter and medic I can be. And again, it's not a competition. It's funny when people call themselves the best firefighter in the world, or I've seen it before. You know, the goal is to be the best version of ourselves. So kind of what general guidelines would you give for anyone in a career that's listening to start pursuing mastery in their own field?
It's really cool. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. First, I would go back to making sure that what you're investing your time and energy in is purposeful to you. So lining up some purpose. And that really begins with the philosophy. And having a great clarity about the guiding principles in your life is a foundational point. Like, what are the principles that are going to help you shape your thoughts, your words, and your actions? And then the second part is like, where are you going? You know, like, who are you and where are you going is a big part of the early work. And then ridiculously investing in mastering your craft and mastering your mind. And both of those are daily practice. And it is uncommon. So it requires an uncommon commitment to both of those. And it's not knowledge acquisition. It's not how you train your mind. It's not how you train your craft. Knowing more is not enough. It is applying and training your craft in new ways, being open to iterating in new ways. And at the same way with the mind is conditioning and training your mind. Do you have the skills, the mental skills to be calm, to generate confidence in any environment, to focus deeply in the present moment in any condition, whether it was at one time boring or one time overwhelming? Do you know how to trust yourself in rugged and hostile environments? You know, optimism certainly is what we've talked about. And do you have the skill to focus your mind on what's in your control as opposed to all the noise of what's not in your control? Those are some basic ones. And then rinse and repeat. You know, I don't want to say that. No two moments are alike, no two days are alike, but literally doing a second version of that the following day and recovering in a world-class process. So I know I've just said a lot, but from a mental standpoint, philosophy, vision, mental skills, psychological framework, the optimism control piece, and then recovering in a world-class way. So that's where I would suggest people start. And if you want more of that, you probably do need to do some reading around it. But, I love that you are listening to some of the podcasts we've been doing. So I love talking about this stuff. Sometimes I get into the weeds. Sometimes it's more conceptual. And we fired up a podcast that's been awesome called Finding Mastery. And, this is exactly what we talk about as well on a regular basis. So there's some of that to be found there as well.
Brilliant. Well, I want to talk about the podcast a little bit more in a moment. But the Compete to Create, is that something that people can now go to the website and actually work on building these skills themselves?
Well, Compete to Create is the business that Coach Carroll, the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, and I have created, taking his intellectual property, my intellectual property, wrapping it together and creating an experience on how enterprise organizations can enhance their culture and train the minds of people inside of it. And it's wonderful, but it's for enterprise folks, enterprise businesses, you know, top 100 companies. That was where we started. And now we're just getting to being able to roll that out to the rest of us. And we're excited. We're just in the pilot phase of seeing if we can get this technology to snap together properly. So we're in the pilot phase right now. We think by fall it's going to be available, but I'd encourage you to maybe punch over to competetocreate.net, and there is a waiting list. If you want to get on the pilot waiting list, there you can check into that, and then also get on the waiting list. I know it sounds kind of crass to say waiting list, but we're not set up to do 10 million people. Like, we're not set up to do that. So we're gonna do waves of individuals as we roll it out. You know, probably in the thousands, the tens of thousands. So, but these things we found that they fill up really quickly. So that's competetocreate.net. It's coming available. And then the podcast, findingmastery.net, are the two places that I'm spending a lot of time.
Yeah. Well, onto the podcast then. So I was introduced to you by, and I should have mentioned this at the beginning, by Peter Park, the trainer who trained Lance Armstrong amongst a whole host of other athletes. And when I always ask a question, which I will ask you at the end as well, which is, can you think of someone who you would recommend to come on the show? You were the name that he recommended. And so when I delved into the podcast, having not come across yours before, I love the fact that you have this smorgasbord of guests. And some of my favorite ones I've listened to so far were Dr. Harry Edwards, David Goggins, and Vitor Belfort. All completely different backgrounds. You got a military guy, you got a, you know, a, member. Was he actually a member of the Black Panther? I forget now. I think he said he was, wasn't he? Dr. Mm-hmm. Edwards, yes. Yeah. And then obviously Vitor from UFC. But again, you have this spectrum of guests, but you're finding these common denominators amongst them. So I guess I'm asking a question after doing a huge explanation, but have you found any common threads now with all these podcasts that you've done, but there's some key common denominators of these successful men and women that you've had so far?
Yeah, I haven't pushed it through the right machine learning to see what the trends actually are. So anything I'm going to say right now is totally biased based on the recency bias, what I've just heard from a theme, you know, or what I want to say, you know. But so I want to reserve that right now. I haven't pushed this through the right machine learning process to know exactly what we have. And it's overwhelming, really. There's just too much insight and wisdom and shared knowledge that I can do that properly right now. I'd like to say that people, you know, are practicing mindfulness and are invested in training their mind, but you know, I don't know yet. And so I want to reserve judgment.
Yeah. Right. Because I've noticed that one thing that I've seen in the guests, I'm just about to hit 100 in a couple of weeks. So not a huge catalog, but it's the optimism, definitely, but the gratitude as well. Some of these men and women have been through, I mean, literally to hell and back. I had a guy called Ishmael Bey on the show a few weeks ago, who was a child soldier in Sierra Leone and got rescued by UNICEF and now is an advocate. He works for UNICEF rescuing boy soldiers. So you talk about forgiveness and kindness and gratitude, but I see that in so many of these people. And again, I'm sure that's completely related to having control of the mind to create that mindset in the first place.
Yeah, awesome. And Peter Park is a legend. So I'm honored that he would recognize and suggest that I come on. So I'm going to thank him for that. Like he's so good at what he does.
Yeah, no, and it was funny. I was talking to Dr. Eric Goodman. I don't know if you know him from Foundation Training, who he co-authored their first book with. And Peter was literally supposed to be evacuated from his home for the mudslides that they had in California a couple months ago. And I told him, well, we can just reschedule the interview. And he was like, no, we're fine. We'll just do the interview and then I'll leave. So he was, such a nice guy. I don't know many people that would do that, but.
Sounds like him.
Yes. All right. Well, I just want to do some wrap-up questions then. So you've been so generous with your time. First one I always like to delve into people's minds. Is there a book that you love to recommend to people? Can be about what we talked about today or something completely different?
Yeah. I think that if you've got a spiritual framework, reinvest in that book. You know, it's the whatever that spiritual framework is, I think is important to investigate. And then I'd say go check out one of the other important spiritual framework texts. And so when I'm talking about like the Quran, the Bible, like what I'm talking about, the Tao Te Ching, like go check out one of the other spiritual practices and see what they're about. The most influential books in the world are the spiritual texts. So why are we always looking for the next hot thing off the shelf? You know, like I don't get that. And so there's next hot books off the shelf that a lot of my friends have written and, you know, that are cool to read for sure. But when you really want to get down to it, go invest in a spiritual text that's not yours. Check out what they have to say. You know, see what they're talking about. And it doesn't mean that you're going to go to hell or whatever. I mean, that's the old ways of thinking. Like, go look. You know, and I love the Tao Te Ching. I think it's amazingly complicated and beautiful, which is the inspired text for Taoism.
So are you suggesting that people prior to our generation had wisdom too?
Yeah, and I'm wondering about our modern day wisdoms. Yes.
I have the same observation. All right. Yeah. So the other, next thing then, is there a movie and or a documentary that you love?
You know, I'm not great at this game. You know, it's like I scan my mind, my memory, and all that comes up really are the ones that I've just recently watched. So I'm not the right person to answer that. You know, I'm going to say Star Wars because it was influential when I was a kid, and I love what they've done with the hero's journey in those books. But just about every Pixar movie has just done a great job with the hero's journey as well. So I'm just not really good at that.
No, that's fine. That's a great answer. All right, so the one I mentioned before, is there a person that you would recommend to come on this show to talk to the first responders and soldiers of the world? Is there a person?
Yeah, there's got to be someone that you might not be familiar with because he's not big time in social media, hasn't written a book. He's a local community member in the professional sport world that is really different and sees the world differently and is fun to be around. He's a community member of mine, and he's got a lot to say on Tribe. And I think it'd be fun for you to connect with Troll Subin. And that'll be a new name for you and your community.
Excellent. And I love that. That's exactly what I want, the gold nuggets that people don't know about. So thank you. So my very last one before we talk about where we can find all your work is, what do you do to decompress?
Yeah, that's a cool question. So as a trained psychologist, licensed as a professional, one of the things that they taught us early on is, so I only see two clients a month now. Like that, and when I spend time with a client, I spend 8 hours with them, and it's super intense. And so I don't have like that rhythm where I see, you know, 6-7 clients a day. But one of the things that they taught us early on was, after you do deep, intense work, do something to relax, to reset. And maybe you just go to the bathroom, wash your hands, take a couple breaths, you know, and just kind of gather yourself. So I don't have this big thing at the end of the day that I do, you know, to shut her down or whatever, but I have this consistent monitoring of how I'm spending my energy. And so it's this like really kind of fluid. I feel like I'm in a river, and I can tell when I'm caught in an eddy, and I can tell when I'm heading over to the banks too fast and I'm going to get smashed up. I can tell when I'm, you know, kind of in rough seas or rough waters, and how to like find my balance in that moment and be a little bit more still. So it's this continual awareness and adjustment, this fine tuning adjustment on a regular basis, mapping the conditions that are happening to finely tuned as I can be to how I want to be as a man. So it's kind of a consistent modulation, if you will. And that sounds super technical and nerdy, and I am a nerd, but like that's how I do it.
No, I love that. That's actually very different than most of the answers I get, but it totally lines up with what we've been talking about. If you're totally in the moment, then that's when you would be start fixing imbalances that you're aware of. Absolutely. Okay, so the very last one then. So you have a book as well, Finding Mastery, and I apologize for not mentioning that earlier. So where can people find your book and then the websites that you have your work on, and if there's one main one that everything tethers off?
Yeah, cool. Thank you for that. The book is actually not in print yet. So you've heard about the book because I've talked about it, but I'm premature. It's written, and we're just shopping it right now to the right places. And so we think fall, like we're going to try to time it up in the fall with the release of our open platform, mindset training platform. So it, you know, it's not available yet. That's why you didn't know about it.
Okay, great. I feel better.
Yeah, no worries on that. So I've talked about it, but it's not out yet. And so the two places, websites, social media is great. I'm loving it. I'm having a good time with it. And so Instagram is Finding Mastery. Twitter is at Michael Gervais, Gervais. LinkedIn is the same. Let's see, where else is there? There's Facebook. We've built a community called Finding Mastery Tribe. So findingmastery.net/tribe. And then also competetocreate.net. Those are the places.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again. I know it's not the community that you normally reach out to, but the mental component, the psychology of the firefighter, the police officer, the paramedic, is an area that we don't explore that much either. And we're very much in the, I would say, the 80s and 90s with a lot of our education, whether it's physical or mental. So I really, really appreciate taking the time to reach out to us. And even though you were saying that you were, you know, on a soapbox or waffling, I disagree 100%. I think that everything you said today has been gold. And I know that people are going to get a lot from this. So thank you again.
No. Thank you. And I'll tell you what, my appreciation, rich appreciation for men and women who serve is, I can't say enough. So I'm grateful to be included in your community. Thank you for doing it. Thank you for the commitment you make to the rest of us. And I have such a deep appreciation for military as well as, armed forces, as well as all of those community-minded people who serve us. And that, you know, who do we call when we're in trouble? We call you guys. So Thank you.